I'd like to propose a toast.
Hello and welcome to Before Brunch. I'm Megan Cassidy.
And I'm Cassie Delaney.
And we are your weekly celebrity, pop culture, arts and social issues podcast. And we go live on Saturday mornings at around 7 a.m.
Sporadically.
This is season two. We agreed that it's not sporadic. There is structure. This is season two. We took a break. Yeah.
Yeah. We just took a mid-season break.
No, after. We took an end of season. This is season two.
Oh, right. OK, this is season two of the new seasons of Before Brunch. Yeah, because okay. It's actually season four.
OK, it's season two of the post-pandemic iteration of Before Brunch.
Welcome to season two. A lot of people reached out to me to ask, were we cancelled? Because the last episode was how much we hate weddings.
We forgot to say that it was the end of season one. It's not that we only decided on the break that it was the end of season one.
Yeah.
We forgot.
Who doesn't love a 4-episode season over 7 weeks?
Exactly. I thought it was just, you know, give them just a little bit, keep them wanting more, treat them mean. But we're back.
Yeah. And that's the beautiful thing about Before Brunch that I explained to my friends when they ask, why is there no consistency with uploading the episodes?
Okay.
It's because,
weird that someone said that.
Yeah, strange.
It's rude.
It's so rude. But basically, Before Brunch is the podcast that started it all. Really.
Oh my God, I love that.
It
more,
is.
More of that.
It's the podcast that started it all. It was the first podcast I'd ever recorded. Yours too, I think.
Yeah.
And it was the one that set me on a path to full-time producing podcasts, now having a podcast production company, now having some tech that supports podcasters. And it's the one that I love the absolute most.
Okay, I'm putting that on my LinkedIn. Did you notice this week I updated my LinkedIn to say that I'm now a director at Outcaster?
Did you?
Yeah.
Did you use your Outcaster profile picture?
Not yet. I'm figuring out how to use that.
Yeah, you should introduce that slowly.
Yeah, I'll find the right time and place for that. But yeah, I updated my LinkedIn.
That's great. Mm-hmm. I'm delighted. And delighted to have you on the board of directors.
Thank you. Okay, so yes, we took a break. Very sorry. We were really meant to come back last week. I got a last minute dentist appointment.
Oh, yeah. I had the shingles before that as well. Like, I'll take full responsibility for missing like 3 weeks. I was unwell.
You did have a minor illness, but I do feel like I was the flakier party when
I was really throwing
break.
You a bone there.
I appreciate that, but I don't want to let you throw yourself under the bus. I was certainly very flaky about the entire thing. But we're back. We're here. Season two.
Season two. Yes. Off with the bang. We're talking about shows being revived.
Yeah. Nostalgia TV, like comfort TV, I think.
Why are we turning so much to 90s shows being revived? Because it's interesting. We've talked about this before in terms of shows we watched when we were younger that didn't age well.
Yes.
And actually, we had a very long conversation before about Friends not aging well, that there's actually quite a lot of transphobic, homophobic jokes in there, you know, and just a lot of the language and lack of diversity when you rewatch it now is kind of like, ah.
Yeah. And I was trying to remember whether we touched on Friends in that conversation because I knew we'd had that conversation. And it's funny because it's quite binary in that you hear people saying, oh, I love 90s TV, it's comfort TV, and it's a more innocent time. And on one hand, we see it as a more innocent time. And on the other hand, it's there's definitely elements there that are really problematic. Like even on a more superficial level with Friends, like the way they treated the issues around weight and being overweight and Monica's fat suit wouldn't fly anymore at all. And that's one of the kind of more superficial issues. Obviously, diversity was non-existent. Mm. Issues around sexual politics it was a very different yardstick than there is today. And yet people are just returning to those shows in their droves, despite us being in an era of what people will consider peak TV.
Yeah.
You know, and people investing in amazing prestige television and television series and series like The Crown, which was like one of the biggest budgets of all time. Mm-hmm. But there's something in us that returns to
the
comfort
laughter
TV.
Maybe it is that we live in this incredible time for media where streamers have changed the game entirely. So the budgets for TV are higher. The retention for TV is a lot higher. So you're seeing Oscar winner Kate Winslet appear in a HBO. Isn't it HBO?
It's HBO, yeah.
Who've done Mare of Easttown. And it's brilliant.
No, it's Sky.
Sky.
Yeah.
But you'll see you know, and our one true love, our shared passion for Reese Witherspoon and Hello Sunshine, and how she invests in a lot of TV work. And
yeah.
Has produced some of the best work we've seen.
Yeah.
With Big Little Lies. Wasn't she involved in The Undoing?
Reese, I don't think, was The Undoing, but Nicole Kidman obviously was. Little Fires Everywhere.
Little Fires Everywhere was stunning.
Incredible. That was on Amazon Prime.
Yeah,
she is now a visionary.
Nine Perfect Strangers, which is a terrible book.
Hated it.
Absolutely awful, but yeah. It's going to be a phenomenal TV show.
I can only imagine. So there's all this investment, but then you have to look at what do the streaming services, what's the purpose of the different types of content? So shows like The Crown or House of Cards, those big budget original series are great for attracting subscribers, but there must be huge financial gains from the content that's there purely to be consumed in volumes and volumes and volumes.
Oh yeah. Well, this is part of the origin story of Netflix, right? So they were able to have a massive bank of content because they bought over, they licensed the content from Star. Originally. So there was that whole big thing that Disney Plus now has Star original programming on it because the license ended. So Netflix can't have that stuff anymore. But it was the thing that launched Netflix was that, yes, they had House of Cards as their big budget show. They completely overpaid, set a massive budget for it and overpaid for it and put all of their eggs in House of Cards being an amazing show, which it was. And thankfully they did it before the scandal. Mm. Of Kevin Spacey, is that, you know, if things had happened in a different order, Netflix wouldn't be around today. If House of Cards had been cancelled after a few episodes because of Kevin Spacey's behaviour, Netflix would be dust.
Yeah, like House of Cards was so crucial in the launch of Netflix, much like The Morning Show was absolutely crucial in the launch of Apple TV.
And they've let us down ever since, I feel.
And gone off the radar. I only said to Aidan this
or
week.
Or like Hamilton with Disney Plus.
Hamilton was Disney Plus. They've all got these shows that kind of their launches were hinged on. Yet Netflix paid $100 million to keep Friends on its platform. I couldn't believe when I heard that stat. Like, that figure is insane. What is that? Like, what is the draw? And it's drawing a whole new generation of viewers as well to this. Is it something around, and something I noticed this week, that I've this new vacancy in my life for like background noise?
Yeah.
Because I can't do anything without having some sort of YouTube video or podcast or TV show playing in the background. Like, I can't, like, it's peak TV, but like, no connectivity for me.
Yeah.
So I'm half reading my phone, half watching Friends. Or we'll be sitting on the couch and we'll be like, what do we feel like watching? Something that we can put on in the background so I can kind of read the newspaper, kind of watch.
Yeah.
You know, it's just become
Sunday afternoon kind of like background noise.
Yeah. But are we paying attention to anything? Like at the end of the week, I'm like, what did I read? What did I watch? What did I consume? Totally consume.
Yeah. Well, I know like Mayor of Easttown, I sit down, my phone's beside me and I don't pick it up and I have to concentrate. There's a couple of shows where I'm like Line of Duty. I had to like pry my eyes open, watch it and almost take notes. You know, like I found it just painful. But there are those big shows that totally consume us, that we could become obsessed with, that we're like dying for the next episode. And then, yeah, you have that kind of background noise thing. And the thing about Friends and maybe why Netflix paid so much money to keep it on the platform is it prompts you how to feel. It prompts you to laugh. Yeah. It has the canned laughter. You don't notice that until you're really looking out for it. And there's something really easy in that old 90s TV sitcom where you're like, oh, that was funny, ha.
Yeah.
You know, a laugh at that. And it is, there are so many brilliant cultural references. You know, if I ever have a friend who's like humble bragging, I'll turn around to them and be like, and I've never had any professional dance lessons.
Yeah.
And we all know that that's Amanda Coolidge.
Her character's name is Amanda.
So it's Jennifer Coolidge. When she's a guest appearance. And so we've had some of the most amazing celebrity guest appearances of all time have been in Friends. And Brad Pitt comes over, you know, meets Jennifer Aniston. And the stories that we were obsessed with at a time when we didn't have, you know, The Undoing, Big Little Lies, Mayor of Easttown level of TV.
Yeah. And I don't even think it's a stretch to say that our sense of humor is probably largely built off of Friends. And the Chandler and the Ross and the Rachel. And like, I think I hear a lot of their intonation in my jokes.
Yeah.
No, I don't tell jokes. But it, my sense of humor, I feel, is quite Chandler-y or quite, yeah. You know, maybe other people disagree. But you've built your whole, like, that's what we watched when we were in our like peak developmental years. That's,
but also it was such a good, strong ensemble cast.
Yeah.
Like, when you look at the other kind of TV programs that have had ensemble casts, and a lot of the time people will say, I love the show, but I don't like anybody individually. There's no one I'm getting behind. Whereas with Friends, you were a Monica or you were a Rachel or you were a Phoebe or you were a Chandler or you were a Joey. No one was a Ross. No one wanted to be a Ross. But like, you were one of them and you identified with them and you emanated their characters.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why it's lasted this test of time. And also their genuine friendship. And I think this is something we were planning on touching upon as well, is the relationship between the people who create something impacts how much other people enjoy the content.
Yeah.
When you look at something like Friends, where they all obviously got on very well together, and maybe that's why the revival is so exciting, is that you want to see them and their interpersonal relationships in real life. And that's reflected in other things, like in the music we consume and the bands we enjoy. You like them because they like each other. Or when you look at the success of something like, you look at the success of podcasts, it's often because of the relationship between the hosts that makes it so
endearing.
Is it endearing.
That you like me?
Well, other people who are listening like us, the 20,000 people.
Because you think I'm funny and that kind of.
I do think you're funny, but I'm not a good benchmark for what is funny because I have a strange sense of humor.
I don't know if I'm funny, but
you're entertaining. Okay. Like I get a kick out of you, Megan.
Oh, great. Okay.
Yeah, I do
get a kick out of you
sometimes. I'll tell like somebody else in my life a funny story that you've told me.
Oh,
like there was the one, and maybe we should save it for like an after hours,
if it's going to be defamatory
dinner.
Then let's
it's
save
not
it.
It's the very funny story about wanting the wine cooler.
Oh my God.
In the hotel, because you had a bottle of wine.
Oh my God, the
It's just a very funny story.
I thought you were referring to a different funny wine story where there was an incident in a Chinese takeaway, not a restaurant, which that was that story, but there was an incident in a Chinese takeaway where I was drinking wine out of a soup cart.
It was difficult. That's not the story. The story was you were having dinner in a restaurant attached to a hotel. You had a sneaky bottle of wine up in the hotel room. You didn't want to just ask and reveal. So you tried to tell them you were finishing a bottle of wine upstairs.
It just got way out of hand because we had the wine bucket beside us in the restaurant and I had the genius idea. And I said to Aiden, like, I know what we can do. We can pretend that we want to bring this wine up to the bedroom and then we'll have a wine bucket for our own wine later. But we had already finished the bottle of wine. So we were bringing an empty bottle of wine up to the bedroom. And it just got all out of hand because Aiden picked up the bucket and the stand. And tried to carry the stand through the restaurant, at which point we were stopped. And then I was like, okay, it's all going to come out. We're trying to bring an empty bottle of wine upstairs. When actually all we needed to do was call down and say, can we have
a wine cooler? You were staying in the hotel.
We were staying in the hotel. It would have been totally fine. But look, things got out of hand.
It's one of those stories where it just escalates and escalates to the point where it looked like Aiden was trying to rob property from the hotel.
We both looked so suspicious.
And then you continued to lie and then not recognize that your wine bottle was empty.
Yeah.
I tried to retell that story to somebody else. I didn't do it justice. Anyway, I do get a kick out of it sideways.
Yeah, look, we digress. Before we move on to ensembles and stuff, I wanted to just dig in a little bit more to what we love about watching nostalgic TV, because I'm also watching Mad Men at the moment, or rewatching it. And I wonder, is it, when I was trying to think this morning, like what does nostalgia, what feelings does that bring up in me? I think it's actually knowing that nothing went wrong, that you can go back and watch it and you know everything's going to be okay. And every Friends episode is 30 minutes and you know at the end it's all going to be okay. And there are five people who like each other and love each other within the world of Friends and also in reality, which really helps. But it's this, there's no danger. There's no fear of, okay, there's going to be like an apocalypse or a huge twist.
Yeah, maybe that's it. It's satisfying. There's no blue ball ending. There's no mystery. There's no...
It's so comfortable.
Yeah.
I think, and it reminds me of, and I know I always bring up WandaVision and you've never watched it.
It's so on my to-do list. I just have this weird reaction when someone tells me passionately to watch something.
Yeah.
I'm like, not for me.
I'm
like,
same.
I've never watched The Crown, Megan.
Oh, and I don't even recommend it. I really didn't enjoy The Crown at all.
I'm glad.
Yeah. But WandaVision, and you know, watch it or don't, whatever.
Yeah, okay, cool.
Reverse psychology.
Yeah. Now I immediately am like, I'll actually watch that now.
Yeah. don't bother if you don't want to. Mm-hmm. But she creates a whole universe that's like, oh, that's such a spoiler. That's such a spoiler. But she's obsessed with, like, that's the last episode. She's obsessed with sitcoms because when she was a kid and there was mayhem and chaos in her house, she would put on a sitcom and she would know that there's going to, as you say, there's canned laughter. Everything's going to be all right in the end. It's all like, you know, it's there's a structure and you know what's going to happen. You can almost predict the punchline of the joke. And it's just so comfortable in that way because it's control in a world that's not controlled. Is there something like that for us? Like even when I'm watching Mad Men, obviously Mad Men is one of the most problematic TV shows ever, and even in the first 10 minutes of the first episode they set it up to be like, this is, you know, the sexual politics here are way off.
Yeah,
there's no divert, there's I think two black characters, and even within the Mad Men universe, the guy who's dating Sheila, who's one of the only black characters, is like so proud of himself for dating her. It's way off, but
it actually feels, because Mad Men is not, is a 90s program, isn't it?
Set in the 50s. Late noughties.
Is it?
Yeah.
Because it feels like it was made. I get confused when I watch Mad Men because I'm like, was this contemporary when it was made? Or is it, it was older but reflective? Obviously it was.
It was 2007 was the series one. And it depicts late 50s, early 60s.
Late 50s into the 70s, I think. It spans quite a bit.
I think maybe 1960, 1961. Maybe it goes into the 70s.
I feel like just thinking about the stuff the characters wear, it might do.
I'm only on season two.
Yeah, I've watched it. I've watched Mad Men a couple of times. Lydia loves Mad Men. Like, it's her favorite TV show and has watched it 3-4 times or something. And yeah, I don't get it. See, I don't feel the pull to watch nostalgic TV.
Oh! Yeah. You're throwing that spanner in the
way. I love old movies. Yeah. I love Death Becomes Her, Steel Magnolias. I love like putting on an old film. I had a little watched the trailer for Harriet the Spy earlier on. I was like, I'd love to watch Little Rascals. You know, love I like that. A Sunday evening watching an old film.
Mm.
But I don't feel compelled to return. I've never watched Friends on Netflix.
I haven't either, but I do watch, and I consider it nostalgia TV, even though it's not 90s or even noughties. I watch Dr. Foster again and again and again, that BBC series. And I do think it's something around, I can put it on in the background. Their home really comforts me. Like, I love their home, the warmth, the lighting in the house. That's as simple as it is. To what draws me back. Their dinner parties with their lovely glasses of wine. That comforts me. It makes me feel good. I've never gotten on board with the likes of Gilmore Girls or Big Bang Theory or any of those really popular ones.
And I only watched, Gossip Girl as an adult. And
I never watched it.
You should watch it because, well, first of all, I watched it knowing who Gossip Girl was, so could only see all the flaws in it, of which there are many. Like, it's one of the worst TV shows of all time. But again, it's interesting because that isn't that old. And it's, again, the sexual politics in the first episode are fucked.
Yeah.
And you're like, this is abhorrent. I hate these characters. Mm. And then you do grow to like them and maybe forgive them a little bit. But I just don't feel like, I'm not particularly excited about the Friends reunion. I'll probably watch it. But like, I think leave the past TV in the past and focus on the really amazing shows that are coming out. I have a list here of all the 90s programs that are due to come back.
She has at some a list
point this year, and you can, I'll read them out and you can tell me on a scale of 1 to 5, 5 being very excited, how excited you are for the revival of these TV shows and how necessary you feel it to be.
I already know I'm 6 out of 5 for Sex and the City.
Okay, we'll talk about that on a different episode because I think Sex and the City is the worst thing that's ever made. Animaniacs.
0.
Rugrats.
5. Didn't know that.
Are you going to sit down and watch Rugrats?
Yeah.
It's going to look different because the technology has advanced. So it's not going to be...
Is it for kids or is it for the original audience? Like, I would do a revisit to Rugrats where Tommy and Chucky and all those are adults. That I would do that.
It's a computer animated TV show on the new Paramount Plus.
For kids?
Yeah.
Well, then no. One.
Do you know what I was excited about? And I never actually watched it, but I thought I was excited. The return of Tracy Beaker.
I love Tracy Beaker and I love Jacqueline Wilson.
So do I. Like, hook that to my veins. Give me my illustrated mum and Tracy Beaker on the
TV
again.
What was the one, Ellie? What was the Jacqueline Wilson that was made for TV and the lead character was Ellie? I'll think of it now.
Was it my illustrated mum?
No. Like, my favourite Jacqueline Wilson book of all time was the one with the twins, Ruby and Garnet, Double Trouble.
Oh. They were fantastic.
Definitive.
The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Zero. Never watched an episode.
Really?
No.
Yeah. Not that excited. Like, that is funny. Are You Afraid of the Dark? That was a great concept. We'll watch that again.
I'm in. We'll watch that again. I would also do Goosebumps.
Yeah. Bring back Are You Afraid of the Dark. I would actually watch all of the old episodes in one sitting now if I could find them.
That's
somewhere.
A real, like, what do they call that? A binge race. If you do it all in 24 hours, that's a binge race.
Next one, Celebrity Deathmatch.
Never heard of it.
It was on MTV and they were little plasticine characters of celebrities and they used to box.
That sounds terrible. That's just not for me.
Rocco's Modern Life.
No, zero.
Saved by the Bell.
I heard that the revival was really good.
Yeah.
But I won't watch it.
Not interested. Haven't heard of this TV show before. All That. No.
All That was Jamie Lynn Spears, wasn't it? And Britney had some cameos on Nickelodeon.
I'm not seeing. It was on Nickelodeon. I'm not seeing Jamie Lynn.
I used to be obsessed.
Here.
I think Jamie Lynn was one of the characters, but not like leading.
This is looking familiar to me, but no, not really interested in it. The next one, Daria.
No. She's got the bob, doesn't she? The
glasses. I've been told I look like Daria before. Blue's Clues.
I loved Blue's Clues. I used to watch it on sick days from school. That's the nostalgia factor. It's like, I would never return to something I didn't watch the first time around.
Yeah.
Whereas so many people in their droves went back to the likes of Gilmore Girls the second time around, having never watched it originally. I would go back to Blue's Clues for like an episode.
That's the only thing on this list that I'm seeing now is Beverly Hills 90210.
No, have because they not it's been tried done. So They've many done it times. Again. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I just think that... Leave them where they're at, like, create new things.
I do. There's definitely a place to create new things, but I totally understand why. I don't understand why Gen Z are hopping on board the Friends train at all, except that there must be a somethingness to Friends that we can't put our finger on that's more than just
it's
what
a
we think it is.
It's a likability thing. And I think you hit on something there with that it's protected and you know it ends well, right?
Yeah.
And you're, like, not investing in something that is... feels like it could be ripped away from you or is problematic. When you think about the way that people bonded to the characters and Friends, it's very similar to the way that the majority of people felt about the BA Test Kitchen, that everyone had their characters, and that was the strongest ensemble cast of anything I've seen in a really long time. Everyone loved them, and they were people, real people, got really behind them, and then it all fell to shit. And now I'm like, I am never mentally committing to a group of friends that aren't my real friends ever again.
Okay, yeah. And that is exactly it. That's scary and hurtful and it pulls the rug out from underneath you. And it happened with Sex and the City when Kim Cattrall outed the fact that she was bullied the whole time.
Fully believe it.
Oh, wow. I totally believe her too. But it totally, the curtain just goes up and you see the wizard behind the curtain.
Yeah, and you feel differently about the people. You feel differently about Sarah Jessica Parker. And do you think, though, with the Sex and the City revival, that they will in any way acknowledge the problematic content of Sex and the City previously?
I think 100%, because I think at the time it was quite forward thinking and, you know, they were... Now it doesn't work and it doesn't fly. But back then it was, for a lot of people, progressive.
Yeah. But do you honestly think that they can have the format of Sarah Jessica Parker walking around dripping in material?
What kind of a mask is she going to have, Cassie? Like, it's going to have to be something insane. Like, her mask will have dragon flames coming out of it, yeah, or something.
There has to be... Like, I just don't think it fits, because it doesn't resonate.
Fits what, though?
It doesn't fit the world we live in.
Fashion still.
Of course there is. But relaunching, and I know that I read something that they were going to acknowledge the pandemic as they revived the series, because these characters are based in New York and we can't ignore, you know, these mad, massive global events and try and create content that doesn't reflect that. But to have Sarah Jessica Parker, who's someone who's so... Well, Carrie Bradshaw, who was vapid at best.
The character, but she knows it was quite a self-aware vacuousness. Like, she was written like that.
Yeah, but do you think that it will have the same impact if we are watching someone who has no real depth, whose whole, we were just talking before we recorded about like these superficial problems that we get bogged down with.
Yeah.
Oh no, being left at the altar was not a superficial problem, but like, she treated those men appallingly, and they all treated each other terrible. And she's a terrible friend.
She's a terrible friend.
Like, how can you get behind her as a character?
I'm not behind her as a character, but I find her really entertaining. And I, when you say, do I think it would have impact? I don't need it to have impact in like a way that moves us forward culturally.
Yeah.
I will watch it because I found it was the first time that I was introduced to a lot of concepts around even female health and, you know,
true, yeah,
genitalia and issues that women have sexually, and probably too young to be exposed to them. But it was the first time I'd ever seen it spoken about, and women really harnessing their sexuality. And, you know, now when you look back, loads of it would never work in 2021. But back then, that just wasn't on TV.
No, and I think that maybe it falls into that formula before that you've always spoken about, is when you were introducing something new and you're introducing something progressive, you give people what they know, what they know, what they know, side of something that they've never experienced before. What they know, something new, what they know. So like, all that progressiveness of Sex and the City was wrapped up in the typical three gals, three gorgeous white women in New York, and fashion, and you know, so it was, I suppose, bubble wrapped in this safety of like, it's just another female orientated TV show set in New York where they're dating and they talk about men and sex.
But it wasn't just another female oriented TV show. It was the first real female ensemble that was a major primetime TV show.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, it broke down barriers in that way. Am I convincing you a little bit on the Sex and City thing? I feel like your eyebrows
I can't move my eyebrows actually because I had a load of Botox. I can't look. I'm raising my eyebrows at you now.
Oh my god!
That's it. It's like my eyes get slightly wider. If anyone would like my referral link, please do DM me. I get €30 off. So I understand its place in
at the time.
Yeah, you know, Sex and the City existed, and now we have Reese Witherspoon having a whole production company where she plans to make a load of women loads of money, and she makes incredible TV shows.
She does. Reese Witherspoon is one of my icons. I just think she is so visionary when it comes to, like, she's behind Gone Girl, she's behind all of the girls, on the Train.
But she when we talk about progressive and something having impact that we maybe don't even realize, Reese Witherspoon created roles, major successful roles, for women in their 50s on primetime TV, and has made the best shows we've had recently.
Yeah, which I would just also just add that Sex and the City did show, like, it was an older set of an ensemble as well.
Yeah, okay.
We weren't seeing women in their 30s to 40s to 50s at that point, and certainly not all female ensembles.
Okay, you've convinced me that it's worthwhile. I'm not going to watch it though.
Look, I wouldn't force anyone to watch it, but I will enjoy it.
One of the things about Sex and the City that is interesting, and it kind of brings back to the other topic about ensemble casts and how important the relationships are between people in the content that we consume, is the point that, like, I don't think we often enough speak about how women work together. The point is that female run businesses or female orientated productions and female artists and musicians and stuff are often, we hear these stories of like bullying or bitchiness or backstabbing or whatever. And we don't talk enough about working relationships between women and how they can be absolutely fantastic and completely progressive. And I think that this idea, these stories of like, Kim was bullied by the rest of the class, you know, the rest of the cast. Jessie leaves Little Mix because she doesn't like the pressure of having to look like the other girls. And all of these like sort of negative connotations that, you know, it's very hard for women to work together are kind of a story that's been fabricated to ensure to keep the women at bay. You know, to kind of make it seem more difficult than it is. So
yeah,
that's maybe an interesting thing. But I think that Sex and the City and the stories that came out of that cast sort of like fed into that stereotype.
Yeah. And is it even a stereotype? Like, I think it's difficult for all people to work together at all times. I think we can just leave the emergency noise in the background and people will just think they'll be OK with it. It's raw. It's rough and ready. It's difficult for anyone to work together anyway.
Like, yeah,
bringing people into a corporate environment together, or in this case, you know, something that's even more charged with emotion because it's entertainment and you're literally paid according to how you're liked and how popular you are.
And for a long time in entertainment, there was one female character. Like, or the female lead or the female supporting character. And there wasn't that gorgeous cast of like diverse selection of women. It was just one.
And maybe that fed into the idea that, you know, if you're coming into a scenario where there is only one spot for the one, like we've talked before about in a band, you know, with NSYNC, it's Justin Timberlake. With One Direction, it's Harry Styles. When there's one spot, of course, there's going to be a bit of elbowing and a little bit of why is the producer always putting her in the center and why is her lighting better than mine? And like, that's natural. And now, because I think we're getting to a place where seeing a full ensemble and equally weighted, the likes of Big Little Lies, where each character has really got their own plot. There is no one person. We're kind of more accepting of, okay, my ego can take a backseat and let's work together on this. But I think it's always natural for egos to become a part of the conversation when you're in the entertainment business. Does it apply more when it's only women or only men?
But I think we hear stories more about how women can't do it. Women can't work together.
Yeah.
Women will fall out. They will bully each other. There'll be a bitchiness about it. There'll be like, you're trying to steal my job or step on my toes, because that's the narrative that's been created around females in the workplace.
Yeah.
And it's not true. And I would like to see, and maybe that's why Friends is different, is because you don't get that sense that they're trying to elbow each other or surpass each other or push each other under the bus. It's a very much a togetherness in Friends that's comforting because it, you know, it's just nice to see, and it's warm. And maybe that's why I'm so resistant to Sex and the City, because I don't want to see those stereotypes again. I don't want to see Sarah Jessica Parker being front and center, recognizing all the ways in which she's bad to her friends, but they accept it because she's the star. And then hearing stories about poor Kim being bullied. And I interviewed Kim a couple of years ago.
Oh, and he dropped something.
Yeah, a name. And she was lovely, bizarre, but absolutely lovely.
And she doesn't even have to be lovely. So what if she is a nightmare? No one should be bullied. And and like, we need to allow women on set to be nightmares. Like, you know, the Tom Cruises of the world and the fucking Clint Eastwoods and the, who's the other? Mel Gibson.
And Christian Bale, but doesn't he punch
Christian
people?
Christian Bale hits people. So that's even going one step further.
We don't want people
we
to
don't
be hit.
We don't want that at all. But, you know, there's this idea that if you're not fitting in with the group, you must be nasty or bitchy or... So what if you're not always nice? You still, you know, that, like when I heard Jessie Nelson was leaving Little Mix, or when I heard Camila Cabello was leaving, what was that girl band?
Fifth Harmony.
My mind goes to either she's the chosen one, which Camila was, or she must be difficult. And that's really annoying that's my go-to gut reaction is, she's obviously difficult. Because when Jerry left Spice Girls, the public narrative was very much, she's difficult.
Yeah.
And when Kim said she didn't want to do the final Sex and City movie, it was, she's difficult. Whereas we don't look at, like, this happens obviously in male scenarios all the time as well, but for some reason, you're right, there's just isn't
it's
the
a
focus.
Different story altogether, because I was doing a piece for Rogue on sexism in the Irish media industry, and one of the things that I encountered in doing this story, and it was a piece of research around how women progress in the workplace when there are less and less opportunities available the higher you get up the ladder, and how that impacts you in a personal level. And the women who are deemed to be successful in workplaces are the ones who enter into the boys' club, yeah, and become one of the boys and normalize the male pattern behavior and normalize, you know, any issues that are going on in the workplace, and they differentiate themselves. And how often do you hear, I'm not like the other girls? What I want to see is us normalizing that actually women work together very fucking well. Mm. Female orientated teams will drive more successful businesses. There was a stat there on the internet about how by 2030, there'll be more female millionaires in the world than men. Now, the reality is probably the men are going to become fucking billionaires. Mm. But if that's the case, we need to start supporting female-run businesses. And there's obviously something there that persists, because right now, female-oriented businesses get less than 2% of available VC funding in the entire world. That is absolutely shocking. When you trace it back to the percentile of women who outperform men at a college level, and then how quickly that declines, mm, that there is only one spot available in a boardroom for a woman 10 years after leaving college.
Yeah.
It's absolutely disgraceful. So we have to break down these stereotypes, and we have to stop buying into the Kim Cattrall is a difficult person when she's working with other women things, because it's going to have an impact on how we run things. And I think that you were right a couple of weeks ago when you said everybody wins when women wins. When women perform well, when women are supported, they are the main drivers of the economy. They have the buying power. They've always, in every single campaign you ever do, it's what are the women doing? They buy the household products. They influence they generally influence their partners' buying decisions.
Yeah.
And they are the real drivers of the economy. So we need female-focused businesses, well-run businesses that have space for women to have maternity leave, for women to progress, for women to build strong teams, for women to be nurtured and to really succeed. Yeah. And I think that it's happening, but I want it to happen faster.
Yeah. And I think what can be perceived as women's weaknesses and what's probably perceived in a corporate environment as a weakness or an Achilles heel is what makes them stronger leaders. It's that absolutely well-rounded emotional approach, which in one hand can be in a meeting. It can make people very uncomfortable if a woman is feeling something or picking something up emotionally or in her gut and says, oh, I feel like you're not listening to me, or you're, that makes people uncomfortable because we're not used to that in a corporate setting, because it's been very male dominated, and men unfortunately don't always feel comfortable saying how they feel or getting visibly upset. They usually, and I don't mean to generalize, but you have to generalize in order to have a conversation, they usually end up getting aggressive or shouting each other down, or doing, you know, who's the alpha male, who's beta,
or and then falling they just back on stats and data, which is obviously appropriate when you're running a business to be supported by data. But female orientated businesses, these female millionaires that we are somehow creating in this difficult patriarchic society, will be different, and it will be a different female orientated economy that we work in, because you bring different things as a female business leader. You bring different things to the table, and that's no harm. When you look at someone like Holly Carnes, who invoked that rule that she is going to what's the word I'm looking for? Sacrifice. She's not voting while Helen McEntee is on maternity leave because it's going to balance out things. And that's true democracy. And instead of stepping in and saying, and, you know, winning the extra vote for the Social Democrats and for her side, she's refraining from voting so that it can be balanced and democratic. And Helen doesn't have to worry about rushing back from maternity leave to, you know, fulfill her ministerial duties, which is fantastic. That's the compassion that female leaders bring to the table. And that's what we need more of in
the
world.
That's it. And my experience has been that the masculine approach, and obviously women can have a masculine approach and men can have a feminine approach, so I'm not saying male or female. The masculine approach is usually figure out the hierarchy very quickly and then don't mess with it. So when you enter a boardroom of men, in the first 10 minutes, we know who's boss and the rest file in underneath. And you don't usually see a masculine approach trying to subvert that.
Yeah.
Women, the feminine approach doesn't usually end up settling itself so easily. And because of that compassion, and the Holly Kearns scenario is a perfect example, we are much more malleable and flexible around giving another woman the floor, even when it is subversion of roles, yeah, or someone that's maybe perceived to be more junior than you. It's a lot more fluid and less structured and hierarchical. And therefore, in a board meeting setting or in an important meeting, when the feminine approach is to speak up and say, I feel X, Y, Z, it makes people uncomfortable because we're so used to that old hierarchical, you know,
this is the fact, this
trench coat and suitcase business approach where I'm the boss and you're not. That's completely flipping now. And we've got new leaders like Jacinda Ardern that take an empathetic approach. And it's much less about who's the junior and who's the senior in the room. That status play is very different. I feel my experience when you're in a room where women are in leadership positions, they are much more flexible to play around with that and hear everyone's voices. And that compassion or that emotional approach that makes people uncomfortable is also the emotional approach that, you know, in a meeting means that you can understand that someone has got maybe something personal going on, so they're not in their A game today.
Yeah.
And it's a much more holistic management. Yeah,
it challenges perception and challenges how we think. And I think you should always, especially in a boardroom, be challenged and have to bring in other people's perspectives and understandings. And I think it will create a world that we live in where we're working, just the way that we work will be different and more flexible. Because if one thing this year has shown is that the way that we work and the way that we've lived hasn't worked. It just isn't working. Everybody, we had to shut down, you know?
Mm.
And yeah, I just think that,
yeah,
that's it.
That's so true. And look, the book Bad Blood, I don't know if you've read it, about Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos.
Oh, I haven't read it yet, but I loved the
podcast. The podcast and the documentary are great. I mean, it's an example of a masculine approach. Elizabeth is a woman, but it was a very masculine approach, or what we would perceive as having been a masculine approach, in that she promoted fear culture and hierarchy and I'm the boss and you must do the X, Y, Z. And it's secretive and it's everyone's scared and you get fired at any minute. And that way of doing things, and it's the Steve Jobs method, and it's old school, doesn't work. The most successful businesses now are the ones that have the more fluid work styles. And, you know, and the stat you gave about the VC, the 2%, the scariest thing about that is that it's actually declining. It's not even increasing. Last year was one of the worst years for female founders.
Yeah, it's horrendous.
Worse than the previous year. And this is taken relatively. It's not just due to the pandemic. Which is terrifying.
Yeah.
And I don't understand why that is, but...
But I think it's because of those stories that women are difficult, that women can't work together. Something will go wrong if you invest in three women. One of the girls will leave the band. One of the girls will at one stage want to leave. Someone will want to go on maternity leave. It's all of these like subconscious, inherent, incessant beliefs that we hold. And so many of them are formed by how we view ensembles of women in the media.
Yeah. But I genuinely, it all comes down to ego. And when it actually does come to working together with people and what we perceive as being someone's ego. So from the outside, when someone leaves or they're not getting on, we apply our own beliefs around ego to that scenario.
Yeah.
She must be difficult. She's less powerful. Cheryl Cole is number one and Nicola is number five. Like we apply that.
Yeah.
We project it onto them. Like I think the reason this podcast works so well is I feel no competitiveness with you. And when you're doing really well and you're like founding your new business and that could make me jealous, but it doesn't. And I think that's why it works.
Yeah.
Whereas there are sometimes, you know, instances where there's male and female ensembles where jealousy and ego is what really.
Yeah. I think the female companies, female founded businesses, and I think the female economy will be more open and there'll be more opportunities created, because this story that you have to like squirrel everything away for yourself, that you have to hold on to the opportunity, that you have to take everything and do it yourself because you can't let somebody else in because then you're not the shining star anymore. That's over.
Yeah.
That's over. Like, we don't work like that anymore. We can't. We all nearly killed ourselves. The world shut down for 18 months. Like, we can't do that anymore. We have to open the floor. We have to. And like, it's not even the pandemic. The Black Lives Matter movement has shown us that we are too particular. We are too selfish holding on to the available opportunities. And the only way that we can flourish is to open those opportunities up and step aside. And as you said many times before, when one woman does well, we all do well.
Yeah.
Like if we support each other, we all do well. And there's a joy in bringing women forward. It doesn't have to be you. You don't have to be the Sarah Jessica Parker at the front of it. You can be the person. You can be the Reese fucking Witherspoon who facilitates success for other women.
Yeah. She has built her career on championing other women.
Yeah.
I'm and trying women's to get her, stories.
Trying to find her email address somewhere to just get out, reach out to her and be like, Reese, I have a business proposition for you.
That's a great project for me to take this week, please.
Absolutely.
I will find her email address.
Yeah.
I would love to. Okay, I think that's us.
We talked for a while there, didn't we?
Yeah, we did. Well, yeah. It's longer than usual, but look, maybe that's the new format for season two.
Do you know, if you split it over 2 weeks, that really takes the pressure off for us. So like you, I'm not saying to you now, Megan, to go and edit it into two. Listener, start it now.
No.
Listen to the TV stuff and then go back to the female economy next Saturday and we'll all have a great time.
Yeah, but I feel like the listener needs to like regain trust in us and that we will come back. And on that note, I want to stay true to the new format that I announced at the end of season one. And that is whereby I shout out a review on the Apple Podcasts app.
Gorgeous.
Okay, so this one, and they're anonymous. You can actually put in your username. So, you know, you can give us praise without having to say who you are if you don't want to align with the brand. Rye Reed says, as close to actual brunch, and I promise this wasn't me or any of my family.
Okay.
As close to the actual brunch as we will have for a while. Genuinely informative and charming pod, which scratches that itch of human conversation without human contact. I thought that was a lovely
review.
That
is exactly what we have tried to do, is speak and keep in touch with people without having to see people.
Yeah.
Gorgeous.
That is a great review. Thank you, Rye Reed. And congratulations on having great taste.
Well done, being
really smart.
And that's
so,
it.
Yeah, first come, first served. Whoever gets the next review in
will be read out in 6 weeks' time.